Welcome everyone to Old English Literature, a lecture course that will take place over the next 14 sessions. My name is Paul Langeslag and I will be your host throughout the term. As I said, the term is one of 14 sessions, the final one of which takes place in the second week of February. Now, incidentally, the second week of February is also the first week of exams for those of you who are taking exams. And accordingly, there will be some here who will already have sat their exam by the time the last session rolls around. And so the final session will not count towards the exam. I do still encourage you to show up for it because we'll make a fun session out of it, looking at what people have done with Old English since the Anglo-Saxon period. Think Tolkien and movies. Now, there's probably some of you here not yet used to the Göttingen system, and so let me just briefly explain that this is a constituent course, a Teilveranstaltung, meaning that you cannot take just this course and get credit for it. Instead, you have to take it along with the companion course. Any assessment, any examination takes place as part of the companion course. So for most of you, that will mean taking an exam that covers both the seminar and the lecture. For some of you, it will mean writing a term paper, in which case the connection with the lecture may be a little bit more abstract. Now, I have uploaded to StudiePay a syllabus containing a schedule that will give you some idea of what topics we deal with in what sessions. Also, it tells you what readings to do ahead of each session. Per week, on average, there'll be one primary text and one secondary text. There'll be some variation. I believe next week I have set two secondary texts, no primary texts. But that's sort of the average. Also online, every week, there will be a list of key concepts for that week. These are some sort of things that I expect you to memorize, whether it is for your exam or for life. These lecture slides will also be online. I tend to upload them about half an hour ahead of the session, so those of you who want to download them to their device and read along and annotate, that should be a possibility. Each set of slides comes with a bibliography at the end, covering just some of the basics of the themes that have been brought up in that session. So if you hear something that strikes your interest, whether for your own purposes or because you want to write a research paper about it, then that might be a starting point. Now, just a word or two about printer settings. Most of the text that I upload will be uploaded in PDFs with one image or one page per image. Now, please don't print them off that way. That would be a waste of paper. Instead, take a little bit of time to get to know your PDF reader's printer options. You should be able to fit at least two pages on a side of A4. Some of you have access, perhaps, to duplex printers, can print double-sided, four pages per sheet of A4. If you happen to print off primary texts, some of them are facing page translations. That means that the odd pages will be Old English, the even pages will be Modern English. If you should read those in Modern English, as I assume you will, of course, you will not print off the odd pages. And finally, and perhaps worst of all, lecture slides, feel free to read them off your screen. You can also print them off, but not at one slide per page. You can fit six or eight onto a page, okay? Spend a little bit of time figuring out printer settings, is all I'm saying. So those are the basics. So let's get to today's session. Today I want to talk about the Anglo-Saxon, so it's going to be more of a historical theme. Now, why would I have chosen this particular image as the title graphic for today's session? For most, how is it representative of this session? How does it fit in with the rest of the term? We'll be speaking mostly about texts, right? Now, texts, one might say, and I'll be setting up a bit of a straw man argument here, so bear with me. Texts are a pretty abstract thing. There's a big difference between texts and artifacts. A text is a one-dimensional object. You can read through it and pause and go back and read again, but that's about it. It's a narrative. A text comes with a particular perspective, a limited perspective, and also with an aim. And that means that every text is a potential curveball. You should be you shouldn't trust a text at first sight, because the aims of the author and also their perspective may not play nice with your own aims as a reader. Now, an artifact like this, my strawman says, is incontrovertible in its physicality. It's there. It says, deal with me. And so you could say there's a big difference between texts and objects. Now, I have two objections to this strict separation between text and object. The first may have already occurred to you, is the fact that the texts that we will be dealing with were written down over 1,000 years ago, long before the internet, long before the printing press, long before mechanical reproduction. And what that means is that each and every copy was painstakingly made with a huge investment of time and labor, meaning that every copy is a unique artifact. So our texts do have physical form. In fact, each copy, and there won't be very many of a text if it takes so much time and money to copy them, each copy is going to be unique because you usually introduce a couple of errors, a couple of typos, we would say today, scribal errors into every new copy, and you might, in fact, amend things on purpose as well. Now, this, my second objection to this strict separation between text and object is the notion that an object cannot be interpreted. Because, of course, they can. First of all, let's look at context. What are we looking at here? This is a buckle that was found at the famous Sutton Hoo ship burial. And the context is that it was found inside a mound, buried inside a ship, which was buried some way into the earth, along with what must have been a corpse. It doesn't actually survive because, you know, human bodies decay, and a lot of grave goods, one of them being this buckle. There's a lot to interpret. For one thing, a burial in a mound, in a ship, with grave goods, one would say, is a pagan burial. At the same time, two of the finds inside this grave were spoons, one of which reads Paulus, the other one reads Saulus. Those are Christian references, suggesting that the individual here buried probably was baptized. At the same time, we think that he may have been a king. Now, I said he because he is surrounded by military objects, weapons, armor, things we associate in the Anglo-Saxon period with men rather than women. We think he was a king because of the wealth with which he was buried. And so we think we can more or less identify him. But all of that, of course, is interpretation. We are reading the context of this object. And what about the object itself? What do we see? Look at it. The first thing that strikes our eye is that the entire thing is covered in a certain pattern, sort of a serpentine pattern, you might say. It's a pattern that we call interlace, and it's characteristic of artwork, and especially metalwork, of Northern Europe in the early Middle Ages. Now, I use the adjective serpentine because we have these ribbons that are overlaid onto each other. But the word serpentine evokes certain associations to those who are versed in Germanic, Scandinavian myth. The first thing that comes to mind is the so-called world serpent, right? There is this idea, we are told by later medieval sources, that the cosmos looked as follows. The landmass on which we live is more or less circular. It's surrounded by an outer ocean, but inside the ocean, just outside of the landmass, lies this massive snake, a serpent all the way around that bites itself in the tail. Just an association that comes with serpentine patterns. Another one, if we look more closely, we see that around the edge of this object, there are little heads. Those must be snakes' heads. So really we're looking at a slithering mass of serpents all on top of each other. Now, slithering masses of serpents have other connotations for scholars of Old Norse literature. Specifically, the legendary hero Ragnar Lothbrok, whom some of you might know from the recent History Channel series Vikings, whose name, by the way, translates as Ragnar Hairy Pants, so you can see why they didn't translate it for television. He is supposed to have made his way to England. He was a king of Norway who was supposed to have made his way to England and actually died there in the snake pit. Okay, another association. But now, what about actual interpretations? Does this buckle mean anything? Well, if we look at the top and the bottom of these two knobs, just right of center, we see two bird's heads with curved beaks, so there must be birds of prey. If you mention this to any scholar of Old Norse myth, they will tell you, oh, well, those must be Hugin and Munin, the two ravens who accompany Odin. Odin, of course, being one of the most prominent gods in the Germanic world, associated with warfare, he who governs Valhalla, or Valhöll, the afterlife for successful warriors. So what I'm saying is, there isn't that much of a distance between texts and history, between text and objects. If anything, if there's any reason why this image is especially fitting for a session dealing with history, it is the very physicality of the fact that it lay buried in English soil for 1,300 years. Now, I'm going to start each of these sessions with a list of key questions. These questions serve two purposes. Firstly, they help structure my lectures, so that each of you knows what to expect. I'll be dealing with each of these questions, maybe not quite in that order, and they won't all get the same amount of attention, but they give you a rough idea. Secondly, they give you a sense of what to come away with today, because at the end of today, you will have at least some partial answers to each of these questions. So today, then, we start with the question, what was Britain like before the coming of the Anglo-Saxons? Where did the Anglo-Saxons come from? What did they do to those who inhabited Britain before they got there? What early written sources do we have to tell us about the culture of the Anglo-Saxons and their ancestors? What were the perspectives of these historiographers, and how might they have been biased? What can we learn about Anglo-Saxon culture from archaeology and art? What about pre-Christian religion? What do we know about it? And how and when did Christianity come to Anglo-Saxon England? And how did it affect the culture already there? Finally, a question that I don't think we'll have time to deal with today is what happened to the Anglo-Saxons? My lecture today divides into two parts, although I think we'll spend an hour on the first part, perhaps 15 minutes on the second, and then there'll be an epilogue that we run out of time for. Now, I'm introducing you to a people, but I'm starting with a place. That's perhaps not so surprising, because in history, boundaries and definitions tend to be a little arbitrary. Just as we define the start of the Middle Ages with reference to a single political event, the sacking of Rome or the disintegration of Rome, and the end of the Middle Ages by means of a cultural development, so the start of humanist sentiment in literature, so also the definition of a people can be a little arbitrary. When it comes to the Anglo-Saxons, we don't call them that until they get to this place, until they get to Britain. The people, of course, pre-exist, but they're not Anglo-Saxons by our definition. So in the late Iron Age, prior to all the invasions, this is roughly what England might have looked like. This particular map divides the various Celtic peoples here into two types. On the one hand, there are those who live in cities and who mint their own coins. These are the peoples living in the south and the east. And then there are those that don't, in the north and the west. Now, you can probably imagine that the building of cities has certain implications. There's a degree of specialization going on and definitely a degree of administration in these societies. Likewise, with the minting of coins, this suggests a certain investedness in trade. And so it's perhaps not surprising that these more advanced, I'll say very carefully, advanced societies are to be found closer to the continent with whom that trade would have taken place. If there was any peace and quiet, it was soon disturbed by the Romans. Julius Caesar was the first leader of Rome to make it to Britain. He got there in 55 before the Common Era with two legions, and he did some fighting in Kent, but didn't really get anywhere, and so he went back home having accomplished nothing. Well, nothing. He, of course, had learned a little bit about the geography of the coasts, which are the best places to land, and the defenses of the people who are there. And so he took this knowledge with him, and he came back the year after, this time with five legions and a knowledge of the geography, and he actually manages to overcome one of the local kingdoms, the Trinovantes. And what he did was he installed a friendly king. So he turned it into what we call a client state. Client state basically meaning that it's nominally autonomous, but in fact is invisibly governed, you could say. It heavily leans upon a larger, more powerful state governed from elsewhere. It's very much what we saw in the Soviet Union with its proxy states prior to 1991. Now, the installation of a client state means that Rome now has certain trade advantages to deal with these Trinovantes. During the 30s and 20s of the last era, some actual invasions and conquests are planned but never carried out, both at the end of the Republican era and at the start of the time of the Roman Empire after 27 BCE. But in the early decades of the new era, the Trinovantes are eventually conquered by their neighbors, and I don't know exactly what that meant for trade relations, but eventually by the 40s, Rome actually comes in full force and makes much of Britain into a Roman province. We have the year 43 AD for that. It's not the entire island was taken by that time. It sort of moved in stages. But eventually, the Romans did make it through most of the island. Not so much Cornwall, not so much Wales, and not all of Scotland. In fact, eventually they settled a little bit further south and had Hadrian's Wall built against the Picts and the Scots. Those were the native inhabitants of the of Scotland there. Now, the Romans came in through Kent in the southeast, and so you can sort of imagine that the larger degree of Romanization would also have been in the south and the east. When I say Romanization, I am referring to Roman troops, Roman administrators, who would have brought with them also writing. Okay, so there must have been literacy in Britain prior to the coming of Christianity in the Anglo-Saxon period. Yes, we also have archaeological evidence that, in fact, there were churches, there was Christianity being practiced. Now, skip for a moment to the continent, and this is what's happening in the last millennium CE and the first centuries BCE and the first centuries CE. excuse me. We believe the Germanic peoples to have their homeland in southern Scandinavia. When I say southern Scandinavia, I mean southern Sweden and in Denmark. Now, they gradually began to push south and east and, to some degree, west along the North Sea. It was the Goths, above all, who moved east, and the rest of the Germanic peoples settled along the Baltic and North Sea areas. Now, the resulting picture of Europe, or this part of Europe, was the following. We have the Roman Empire enveloping the Mediterranean, and then we have the Germanic territories to the north. Specifically, this is north of the rivers Rhine and Danube, which for most of the time was sort of a hard boundary between the two. The Romans and the Germanic people seem not to have had much interaction, not much friendly interaction at any rate, so not much trade. The Romans refer to the Germanic peoples in sort of disparaging terms. They call them barbarians, and so probably not much trade. But we do have, from the very end of the first century of our era, a fairly detailed account by a Roman named Tacitus. Now, before we dive into Tacitus and his book, The Grammania, we have to remember what I just said about texts, because this is going to be sort of a theme throughout today's session and maybe also throughout the term, the idea that every text should be mistrusted because it comes with a limited perspective and deliberate aims. In the case of Tacitus, we should distrust it because we don't really know how many of these Germanic peoples he visited. Perhaps a lot of this is just hearsay. Someone must have been there, but we don't know how reliable that is. Secondly, what is Tacitus's aim in writing this book? If we read between the lines, we get a sense that actually he was looking to critique his own people, critique the Romans, with reference to their neighbors. So we should proceed very carefully. Okay, Tacitus then writes, "The Germani themselves are indigenous, I believe, and have in no way been mixed by the arrivals and alliances of other peoples. Because in the past, those who sought to exchange their old territory for new did not come by land, but were carried by fleets. And the ocean beyond Germania, immeasurable and, so to speak, hostile, is visited by very few ships from our parts. Moreover, quite apart from the danger of a rough and unknown sea, who would abandon Asia or Africa or Italy and seek out Germany with its unlovely landscape and harsh climate, dreary to inhabit and behold, if it were not one's native land?" Now, these words of Tacitus, I think, may contain a wise lesson for us in this context of refugee crisis. I think we would do well to remember that no one comes to Germany for its climate and its landscape. Going on, he writes, "Consequently, they also all have the same physical appearance, so far as can be said, for so numerous a people. Fierce blue eyes, tawny hair, bodies that are big, but strong only in attack. They lack an equivalent endurance of labor and toils, and have no resistance at all to thirst and heat. But to cold and lack of food, the climate and soil have made them accustomed. As for gods, Mercury, by which Tacitus means Woden, I'll explain that a little bit later. It's a matter of translation. So Woden is the only one, is the one they worship most. They attend to auspices and lots like no one else. When battle has been joined, it is shameful for a leader to be surpassed in valor, shameful for his retinue to lag behind. Whenever not engaged in war, they spend a little time hunting, but much more relaxing, devoting themselves to sleep and food. The Germanic peoples inhabit no cities." Just a word now to talk a little bit about the concepts of DNA, culture, and language, because when we read Tacitus, he's describing the Germanic peoples mostly with reference to their culture, right, their habits, their customs, but to some degree also to their DNA, because he describes the fact that they don't seem to intermingle because they all look the same. He doesn't discuss language all that much. But we should recognize that these three concepts, so language, DNA, and culture, they tend to travel together, but they need not. And so they tend to be sort of a tangled mass that we occasionally need to disentangle. Because, for instance, sure, it's reasonable to assume that when the Scandinavians or the Germanic peoples pushed south from Scandinavia, that they took with them their culture, their language, and their cousins. But it doesn't always have to be that way. For instance, if a small elite manages to conquer a larger people that they're not related to and who speak a different language, then the subjugated people will, over time, probably, adopt the language of the conquerors, because that is now the prestige language. But that doesn't automatically mean that this elite will allow them to also intermarry with them. And it's not necessarily certain that the culture will be adopted to the same degree. So that's something to keep in mind as we talk about Germanic speakers, Germanic peoples, and so forth. Now, the fourth through roughly eight centuries of our era are referred to commonly as the migration period. Migration period meaning that lots of people were moving about. Now, maps like this one can be a little bit misleading in the sense that if you look at it, it really only refers to Germanic peoples. But if you think about it, if you take all of Rome as one state, and you assume that everyone living in that massive state is Roman, then you're not going to find their movements on a map like this. Okay, but still it's true that Germanic peoples were moving around a lot in this time. And probably a very important factor in that is the disintegration of Rome. Because they had been holding out against the barbarians up at the Rhine and up at the Danube, but eventually, if the system as a whole, if the country as a whole grows weaker, the Germanic peoples may push through at some point. And that is, in fact, what we see happening. Specifically, with reference to Anglo-Saxon England, the year 410, or thereabouts, is very important, because at this time, it is Rome itself that is under threat. And therefore, Rome decides to withdraw its military presence from Britain. So this island that had been, or much of which had been, a Roman province for such a long time, was basically abandoned. You can imagine that that leaves a power vacuum for, first of all, the Picts and the Scots up in Scotland to push south, but also for just anyone to migrate into England. And that is the background against which we should see the Anglo-Saxon migrations. And so let's turn to a source that is actually Anglo-Saxon. It's a lot later. This is from the Venerable Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People, which was completed in the year 731. So he's three centuries removed from the events that he's describing, but at least he does have this Anglo-Saxon perspective. So he writes then, in the year of our Lord 449, which, by the way, is very specific, the nation of the Angles, or Saxons, being invited by the aforesaid king, that would be Vortigern, king of the Romano-British, we refer to the British by this point as Romano-British for their having intermingled with the Roman settlers, arrived in Britain with three ships of war and had a place in which to settle assigned to them by that same king in the eastern part of the island on the pretext of fighting in defense of their country, being Britain, whilst their real intentions were to conquer it. Accordingly, they engaged with the enemy, who were come from the north to give battle. This would be the Picts. And the Saxons obtained the victory. When the news of their success and of the fertility of the country and the cowardice of the Britons reached their own home, a more considerable fleet was quickly sent over, bringing a greater number of men. And these, being added to the former army, made up an invincible force. The newcomers received of the Britons a place to inhabit among them, upon condition that they should wage war against their enemies for the peace and security of the country, whilst the Britons agreed to furnish them with pay. Okay, so Bede says there's these Angles and Saxons coming in as mercenaries, fighting against the Picts on behalf of the British, but their real intention was to take over the island. He now gets more specific about who's coming and where they go. He writes, those who came over were of the three most powerful nations of Germany, Saxons, Angles, and Jutes. From the Jutes are descended the people of Kent, and of the Isle of Wight, including those in the province of the West Saxons, who are to this day called Jutes, seated opposite to the Isle of Wight. From the Saxons, that is the country which is now called Old Saxony, that would be the Elbe-Weser Triangle north in the northern part of this Bundesland, came the East Saxons, the South Saxons, and the West Saxons. From the Angles, that is the country which is called Angulus, that would be Schleswig-Holstein on both sides of the border today, and which is said from that time to have remained desert to this day, that is pretty much true, between the provinces of the Jutes and the Saxons are descended the East Angles, the Midland Angles, the Mercians, all the race of the Northumbrians, that is, of those nations that dwell on the north side of the River Humber, and the other nations of the Angles. Okay, let's visualize this. So Bede says there's essentially three tribes or three nations involved. There's the Jutes of Jutland, the northern part of Denmark. There's the Angles of Schleswig-Holstein. and as the Saxons of the Elbe-Weser Triangle. And they actually migrated to Britain in a pattern that is still identifiable 3 centuries later. Specifically, the Angles moved to the north, the Saxons to the south, and the Jutes into Kent. Now, you'll notice that there is another area here that is colored on the map, and that's for good reason. Even though Bede does not mention them, the Frisians probably did come along and settle in large numbers in England. And we have a number of reasons to believe this. Firstly, there is the linguistic evidence, because Frisian and English stand to one side in terms of how close they are to each other compared to all the other West Germanic languages. There's also some place name evidence, towns that are called after Frisians in Britain. And there's also some early accounts that actually mention them there. We'll look at a couple of those. Procopius was a 6th century Greek writer, so that means he was not very close to the action, but he was writing 2 centuries before Bede, so only 1 century after the events as dated by Bede. And he says that the island of Brittia, as he calls it, is inhabited by 3 very numerous nations, each having 1 king over it. That's probably not very reliable information. The earliest information that we have from the Anglo-Saxons has them inhabiting a large number of kingdoms, but we'll let it pass. And the names of these nations are Anglii, Frisones, and Britones, the last being named from the island itself. And so great appears to be the population of these nations that every year they emigrate thence in large companies with their women and children and go to the land of the Franks. Again, this last claim is something that's not familiar to me. Basically, Procopius is claiming that by a century after what Bede says was the time of immigration, the Germanic speakers have become so populous in England that now they're moving en masse to Francia. I'm not aware that there's evidence for that, but what is significant here is the fact that he mentions the Frisians as inhabiting Britain. We also have another much later source from Scandinavia. This is a skaldic poem that was composed in the 11th century for Knut, the Danish king, who was also king of Norway, and who then became the king of England in 1016 after the Battle of Brentford in the London area. And what the poet says, addressing Knut, is Fjörlösa hech frisi fritskerri thar gerdu, etc. I heard that you, warrior, killed Frisians there. You demolished Brentford along with the settled areas. Edmund's noble descendant received dangerous wounds. The Danish army shot at the king's men with spears then, and you chased the retreat. Now, Brentford is where the battle took place. We know this. Edmund is the king who was defeated by Knut, so that fits. But we're not aware that Frisians were involved in this conflict. Now, those of you who have studied metrics or poetry may already have noticed that the poet needs an F. Fjörlösa hech frisi fritskerre. This is alliterative verse, right? You need 3 Fs per 2 lines in this case. And so apparently it was acceptable when you needed an F to call the English Frisians. Okay, now this is 11th century evidence. Again, that's much later than the 6th century evidence from Procopius, but it's still interesting. Okay, let's leave the Frisians and look at this map again. Have a close look at the area occupied by the Jutes, Angles, Saxons, and Frisians, that whole stretch together. And now look at this other map, which depicts the distribution of the different languages, different Germanic languages and branches of the Germanic language family. As you see, this red area is a very close match for the area described by Bede plus the Frisians. And now, it's possible that there's a degree of circular reasoning here, but it would suggest that the peoples migrating to Britain all had languages that are very close to each other. Now, you wouldn't perhaps today say that Frisian is very close to Low German, but they're mutually intelligible, and at the time they would have been more so. So this map depicts, in fact, and we'll go into more detail next week, the basic tripartition of the Germanic languages. We speak of North Germanic, that refers to what at the time was Old Norse in its Western and Eastern variants. Today, of course, the Scandinavian languages, being Swedish and Danish and Norwegian and Faroese and Icelandic and so forth. The East Germanic languages, of which none now survives, but there is one language that has at least left a small body of literature, biblical literature, and that is Gothic. And then there are the West Germanic languages, that's the rest of us. So your German and your Dutch and your Afrikaans and your Frisian and your English and so forth. And that West Germanic group is traditionally subdivided into three. There is Ingvaionic, that would be the so-called North Germanic, North Sea Germanic languages. Then there's Irminonic, that is basically the language group that gave rise to High German, the mother tongue of perhaps most people in this room. And then Isvaionic, which is supposed to have given rise to Franconian. People still debate whether there was such a thing as Franconian, but that's not too important for our purposes now. Now, Bede goes on and goes a little bit into the mythical realm here when he says that the first commanders are said to have been the two brothers Hengist and Horsa. Now, if you take one piece of advice from me, do not call your sons Hengist and Horsa. It means stallion and horse. It's just not what you want to call your sons. They were the sons of Vikilsus, whose father was Vitter, son of Vector, son of Woden, from whose stock the royal race of many provinces trace their descent. This is true. Both in Bede's time and in the centuries after, it was popular among the royalty to draw up lists, genealogical lists, tracing their descent back to Adam, but via Woden. So even if they didn't practice paganism, there was apparently an interest in associating yourself with this pagan god. In a short time, swarms of the aforesaid nations came over into the island, and the foreigners began to increase so much that they became a source of terror to the natives themselves, who had invited them. Then, having on a sudden entered into league with the Picts, so these are the people in the north, whom they had by this time repelled by force of arms, they began to turn their weapons against their allies. At first, they obliged them to furnish a greater quantity of provisions, and, seeking an occasion of quarrel, protested that unless more plentiful supplies were brought them, they would break the league and ravage all the island. Nor were they backward in putting their threats into execution. In short, the fire kindled by the hands of the pagans proved God's just vengeance for the crimes of the people, not unlike that which, being of old lighted by the Chaldeans, consumed the walls and all the buildings of Jerusalem. For here too, through the agency of the pitiless conqueror, yet by the disposal of the just judge, it ravaged all the neighboring cities and country, spread the conflagration from the eastern to the western sea without any opposition, and overran the whole face of the doomed island. This seems like a good point to pause and talk about Bede's perspective. Bede was an Anglo-Saxon. You've already seen that he referred to the British as cowardly, so that perhaps is something that, you know, you expect an Anglo-Saxon to write. But as you can see here, he isn't too keen on the Anglo-Saxons either, at least not the ones from the 5th century. He doesn't seem to have a loyalty to them. And that is not so hard to understand if you know that Bede was an oblate. That is, his parents took him at the age of 7 and dropped him off at the nearest monastery, and he spent the rest of his life there. Okay, so he grew up and spent his entire life among monks, reading his Bible, reading his theology. And so he would have identified first and foremost as a Christian, and maybe at the very distant second as an Anglo-Saxon. But definitely not with the Anglo-Saxons of the 5th century, who, after all, were pagans. It's only once they become Christians that he gets to see them as his brothers and sisters. Now, you will have noticed that here in blue, Bede is basically saying that the coming of the Anglo-Saxons was punishment of the British for their sins. Okay, this sort of penitential thinking, making clear that Bede is not trying to provide you with an objective account of what happened. And that's actually perfectly normal in his period, because historiography in the early Middle Ages was not an objective account of history. It was an attempt to derive spiritual significance from the facts of history. This is a trend that was set by St. Augustine, who lived in the 4th and 5th centuries and wrote his magnum opus, The City of God, in response to the claim, to the accusation, that Rome fell because of Christianity. The idea being that Christians introduced their soft virtues rather than military virtues, and this led to an inner disintegration of the empire. And Augustine wrote his book to say, actually, no, I see two forces moving in history, opposing each other, a force of good and a force of evil, a force of Christ and a force of Satan. And this is how I see it play out over the history of Rome. A pupil of Augustine, named Orosius, then took this cue and wrote a book called History Against the Pagans, which is a pretty cool title, but again, it doesn't really qualify as objective historiography. And so it is in this tradition that Bede writes his book, which is called The Ecclesiastical History of the English People. Okay, so there's always this church perspective, this ecclesiastical perspective. And part of that is the idea that if you suffer defeat as a nation, you must have done something wrong, you must have done something to offend God. It gets a little nastier here. Public as well as private buildings were overturned. The priests were everywhere slain before the altars. No respect was shown for office. The prelates, with the people, were destroyed with fire and sword. Nor were there any left to bury those who had been thus cruelly slaughtered. Some of the miserable remnant, being taken in the mountains, were butchered in heaps. Others, spent with hunger, came forth and submitted themselves to the enemy, to undergo for the sake of food perpetual servitude, if they were not killed upon the spot. Some, with sorrowful hearts, fled beyond the seas. Others, remaining in their own country, led a miserable life of terror and anxiety of mind among the mountains, woods, and crags. There's two things of importance in this passage. Firstly, Bede claims that Christianity was widespread prior to the coming of the Anglo-Saxons, because he says priests were everywhere slain before the altars. Now, you can tell from his phrasing that there's a degree of exaggeration in his account, but it is consistent with our belief, and in fact with archaeological evidence, that Christianity at least existed prior to the coming of the Anglo-Saxons. The second thing of note in this passage is the fact that Bede has an explanation for what happened to the Celts. Specifically, he says they were massacred, driven out, and enslaved. And this is important because this has been the default understanding of what happened for a very long time. We've begun to question that, but it's still sort of part of the common understanding of what happened. Now, Bede was actually not the first to write about these events. He had a source from the 6th century who was a British priest named Gildas. This is interesting because Gildas, of course, being British, was both local and chronologically fairly close to the action, just about a century after these things happened. And he shares with Bede this penitential understanding. He says, "Meanwhile, God, being willing to purify his family, who were infected by so deep a stain of woe, and at the hearing only of their calamities to amend them, a vague rumor suddenly, as if on wings, reaches the ears of all, that their inveterate foes were rapidly approaching to destroy the whole country, and to take possession of it, as of old, from one end to the other. But yet they derive no advantage from this intelligence, for, like frantic beasts taking the bit of reason between their teeth, they abandoned the safe and narrow road and rushed forward upon the broad downward path of vice, which leads to death." Okay, so again we get the sense that the British are being punished for their sins. Incidentally, this particular passage has strong early 21st century resonances. When you hear him write about actionable intelligence, about an enemy that is planning an attack, but then no one acts upon it because they're too steeped in their sins. I'll say no more. Then all the counselors, together with that proud tyrant Vortigern, the British king, were so blinded that, as a protection to their country, they sealed its doom by inviting in among them, like wolves into the sheepfold, the fierce and impious Saxons, a race hateful both to God and men, to repel the invasions of the northern nations. It's interesting that Gildas would say that the Saxons are hated by God and yet used as his vehicle for vengeance. It is, in fact, very similar to a passage that we have in Beowulf, in which Grendel, the monster that attacks the whole of the Danish, is said to bear God's anger. And bearing God's anger can be understood in two ways, because it means that God is angry with him, or it means that he is a vehicle of God's anger directed against the Danes. And sometimes people have understood it in both ways simultaneously. And definitely that is how Gildas means it. The Saxons are hated by God, and yet God uses them as an instrument against the British who have sinned. Now, notice the beastly nature of his description of the Angles and the Saxons. A multitude of whelps came forth from the lair of this barbaric lioness, in three keels, as they call them, that is, in three ships of war, with their sails wafted by the wind, and with omens and prophecies favorable. For it was foretold by a certain soothsayer among them that they should occupy the country to which they were sailing 300 years, and half of that time, 150 years, should plunder and despoil the same. They first landed on the eastern side of the island by the invitation of the unlucky king, and there fixed their sharp talons, apparently to fight in favor of the island, but, alas, more truly against it. Their motherland, finding her first brood thus successful, sends forth a larger company of her wolfish offspring, which, sailing over, join themselves to their bastard-born comrades. Now, after what I've told you about the unreliability of texts, you may now all be wondering, okay, but can we trust this Bede and his source, Gildas? And the answer to that would be to look to archaeologists and DNA experts and ask them, well, was there in fact a sudden influx of foreign DNA, of foreigners? Is there an influx of foreign cultural elements? And in terms of the DNA evidence, it's kind of a complex picture. So, and I'm not an expert either, so I cannot give you a detailed, definitive answer today, but I will touch on a number of things. Firstly, it has been found by the analysis of burial sites in northern Germany that there was a decrease in men in northern Germany by the mid-5th century. Now, this does not mean that there were fewer young men that were dead in the cemetery by that time, but rather they would have calculated back from the end of the century, there's fewer old men, and so they must have left. So this would be, it's especially people or men aged 20 to 40, so this would be consistent with a large-scale foreign military expedition. On the other hand, this shortage of men does not translate into a surplus of male burials in England. Now, you can think of a number of explanations for that. Quite recently, there was this Viking mass grave that was unearthed, right? Perhaps people would not get the same amount of honors. But at least this evidence suggests, I think it's based on the brontium contained in the teeth of the corpses, that there's an even balance between local and non-local males in the cemeteries, males and females, in fact, and of all ages. So there is not a slant towards the more military part of the demographic. Now, some 15 years ago, people did study the Y chromosome haplotypes in the current generation, in people alive today, across central Britain into Wales, and in Norway and in Frisia, and compared them, and they found that, in fact, the DNA, the male DNA, was virtually indistinguishable between England, Norway, and Frisia, but it contrasted with the population of Wales. So that would suggest that a lot of people came in, a lot of men, in fact, came in from the continent. In fact, the authors of this study calculate that by the mid-5th century, there might have been a sudden influx, in which case men from these other nations would have contributed somewhere between 50 and 100% of male genes to the gene pool in England. There's a lot of caveats with this research, though, I should say. Most importantly, perhaps, the question of background immigration. Because the question of how common was it to migrate at the time, if there was a lot of people moving in, or a moderate amount of people moving in over a longer period, it would have the same results as a sudden mass influx. So it's a little bit uncertain. For instance, if we take into account that the Romans had withdrawn by 410 and left this massive power vacuum, you can imagine that immigration became a much easier thing for a longer period of time. So if we assume that after 410, migration simply increased and remained greater for a long period, let's say throughout the 5th century, perhaps also throughout the 6th century, that also would account for a large influx of men into this area. So what did happen to the Celts? The conventional explanation is to basically follow Bede and to say, well, they either exterminated them or they sent them away. You'll be aware that there is such a thing as a Celtic fringe today in Britain. That means that the Celtic-speaking population, at least, but also their DNA base, is based along the western fringe of the islands. Right, there's Cornwall, there's Wales, there's, of course, Scotland, and there's Ireland. And so people have assumed, well, Bede must have been right. They basically just drove them off and took the land for themselves. There was very little intermingling. And we have evidence that backs this up because there are almost no words from Celtic that made it into Old English at the time. There's a few. There's a word like drú, meaning magician. There's a word like brok, meaning badger. But it's a very small base. These, of course, are also not words that have survived, so they didn't have a stable place in the language. But most of the words borrowed into English, whether old or modern or later, were borrowed either prior to the migration to England. So, for instance, the Old English word Reiche, which is cognate with the German word Reich, meaning kingdom, was borrowed from Celtic, because that is a Celtic borrowing, prior to the migration to England, so from Celts who lived on the continent. And likewise, a word like crag was borrowed in the Middle English period. And so, many people have said, that is what must have happened. But recently, people have come to a different conclusion. They've said, well, look, what happens if a small elite group takes control over a large group that they subjugate to them, and this is the scenario that we talked about earlier, is that you get a lot of people learning the language of their conquerors. You get a lot of speakers of English as a second language, right? Something we're familiar with around here. And what happens if you speak English as a second language is not that you start introducing words from your mother tongue into your new language, because you're not stupid. You know that you're supposed to use the words of the new language. So you learn them, you look them up in the dictionary, you ask your neighbor, you start using those words. Instead, what does happen is that people transferred their pronunciation from their mother tongue, their intonation, and syntactic patterns onto the target language. Because these are things that you learn when you're very young. You learn them as an infant, and then when you learn your second or your third language, you tend to take them with you, to transfer them onto the new language. Now, there's not that much we can say about intonation patterns, or certainly not in today's format, but syntax is accessible to us because we have a large body of Old English writing. We also have Modern English. And in fact, it turns out that English syntax today is different from the other West Germanic languages and their syntax in ways in which it is closer to the Celtic languages. So in fact, it is quite likely that the Celts and the Anglo-Saxons formed a new society that they did merge, even if most of the male DNA is from abroad. And in fact, these lower echelons of society, the Celts, would have quickly acculturated, adopted the language, adopted the customs of their conquerors. And one word that speaks in favor of this reading is the Old English word Welch, which means foreigner, and specifically Welshman, which also came to mean slave, just as the word slave in English actually originally derives from the word for the Slavic peoples. Okay, it looks like we have a fair bit of time left to talk about culture. I will not be giving you an overview of Anglo-Saxon culture, but I will touch on a couple of things here and there. Very important for an understanding of Anglo-Saxon culture is an understanding of its history of religion. Because a lot of what survives, especially in writing, is heavily influenced by Christianity or has Christian themes and aims. Especially in writing, I say, because, of course, writing was in the hands of the clergy, and the clergy would only perpetuate what was worth perpetuating in their eyes. On the one hand, you don't want to waste parchment because you have to slaughter a sheep for every few pages. On the other hand, you also don't want to write down everything that contradicts Roman doctrine. But also in the world of art, we get a huge shift towards Christian art, the depiction of Christian scenes. So what do we know about religion prior to the coming of Christianity? The answer is, accordingly, very little. But one thing that we can do is we can go back once more to Tacitus and see what he has to say about Germanic religion and sort of try to project forward to Anglo-Saxon England. He writes, "As for gods, Mercury is the one they worship most, and on certain days they think it right to propitiate him even with human victims. Hercules and Mars, they appease with lawful animals." Now, I'd already mentioned we shouldn't read these god names as is, because Tacitus used and seems to have pioneered this concept of translatio or interpretatio romana, which is you take Germanic god names and you substitute the nearest equivalent Roman countertype. So Mercury we should read as Woden, Hercules we should read as Thor, and Mars we should read as Tyr, or Tyr in the Old Norse tradition. In fact, this practice was also reversed. We could then call it Interpretatio Germanica. For instance, in the days of the names of the days of the week, the Romans gave their weekdays pagan Roman deities as names. And you can still see that, of course, in French, for instance, your mardi, mercredi, jeudi, vendredi. These are named for Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, and Venus. And in Germanic areas, people would take these names and substitute Germanic names. And so we get our Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, which are named for Tyr, Woden, Thor, and Freya. But what we can learn from this is that it was at least a polytheistic system. I don't know what we should think about Tacitus claiming that they sacrificed humans. I always get a little suspicious when I read something like that. But then again, we probably need more context to say anything sensible about that. In the next chapter, Tacitus writes, "In other matters, they judged it not in accord with the greatness of the gods to confine them with walls or to liken them in appearance to any human countenance. They consecrate woods and groves, and the mystery that they see only in their awe, they call by the names of gods." Now, this is important. Tacitus tells us that worship takes place outdoors, which is interesting from an archaeological perspective, because if, as an archaeologist, you find something that looks to you like a ritual site, then the question of is it indoors or is it outdoors is going to help you interpret what's going on. Likewise, of great importance, is this mention of the sanctity of trees, because this is something that has been proved time and again. in accounts of early Germanic religion. Right here in Germany, there was the Irminsul, the holy tree, which Charlemagne came and chopped down during his attempts to overcome the Saxons. In Hessen, there was the Oak of Thor, which Boniface came and chopped down to prove that the pagan gods were powerless. And in Old Norse tradition, there is the world tree, Yggdrasil, which takes a very central place in the cosmology there. So there's a lot of evidence suggesting that, yes, the early Germanic peoples, and therefore likely also the Anglo-Saxons, worshipped trees and other outdoor objects. Tacitus goes on, from their sacred groves, they remove certain images and symbols that they carry into battle. An especially strong incitement to courage is the fact that a wedge is formed not by accident or random conglomeration, but through family connections and kinship. And nearby are the loved ones from whom are heard the shrieks of women and the wails of babes. So again, here we see a reference to the sanctity of trees. We also see that they use holy objects as objects of protection in battle. And that gives us some indication of at least one dimension of their religion, because it suggests that they use their religion to improve their lives right here. So it's sort of a this-worldly religion, rather than one focused on the afterlife, or at least the evidence that we've seen is focused on the here and now. We already saw this other quotation: when battle has been joined, it is shameful for a leader to be surpassed in valor, shameful for his retinue to lag behind. This is a hint at comitatus culture, this idea that there is a leader, a lord or a king, who has his retainers, and often we're told that they sort of live together in one hall. These retainers fight for him, fight on his behalf, and in return they get part of the spoils. This is something that we see lots of in Beowulf and other Germanic heroic literature. And it, like all these other elements that we find in the first century accounts by Tacitus, is consistent with a lot of what we find in heroic literature, such as Beowulf. So why would Germanic peoples convert to Christianity at all is a very good question. Because, you see, Christianity thrives in a culture of urbanization, multiculturalism, a society in which you don't know your neighbors, in which you don't have a lot of social cohesion. Because if you live by yourself in a large city and you don't know anyone, you're more likely to join the local church, because the Christian church is it uses a vocabulary of brothers and sisters, right? You join the church and suddenly you have all these brothers and sisters. Now, why would that not be attractive to Germanic peoples? Germanic peoples were rural, right? They lived in small villages. They had really strong social cohesion because they lived around the people that were related to them. In fact, we just saw that in battle, if Tacitus is right about this, battle formations were drawn up not on any strategic basis other than blood relations. So you're fighting side by side with your brothers and your cousins, giving you an extra incitement to give it your most. So we get, everywhere we look, we get a sense of very strong family ties, very strong social ties. And then they have this religion that, as far as our evidence allows us to say, is based on the here and now rather than personal salvation. So there isn't a strong incentive to convert as an individual. As a ruler, however, there could be big strategic advantages to converting to Christianity. Because going back to this sort of village culture with local gods, we worship our god in this village, and the next village over has its own god that it worships, that paints a picture where these two villages will never integrate because they are essentially different in their mode of worship. And in much the same vein, I can say that, okay, everyone in my village clearly belongs to my society because our everyday life, we interact with each other. There's just so much overlap. But the same sort of a village on the other side of the country, I can't see myself having anything in common with them. But now, if you make everyone in the country a Christian, suddenly everyone is a brother and a sister. So we've just created what we call an imagined community. And this was interesting to kings because it meant that you could not only strengthen the ties, the social cohesion within your kingdom, you could even expand your kingdom. And as long as you get everyone to convert, you can keep this larger nation together. And so what we see happening is a top-down conversion in which it is always the kings who first are baptized and then order their nobles to also be baptized. And then they bring in the Roman church, which is large infrastructure, which then begins to preach to the larger population. And so what happens at the very end of the 6th century is that Pope Gregory the Great sends a gentleman by the name of Augustine to England, to Kent, to try and convert it. Now, generally, kings, pagan kings, kings in pagan countries, were quite open to missionary activity because a polytheistic religion is not jealous. You can come and preach all you like. In this particular case, in the Kingdom of Kent, there was the additional feature that the king was married to a Christian woman from Francia. So it's not as though there was no knowledge of Christianity in England. They did, of course, interact with people on the continent, and on the continent, Christianity was pretty widespread. And so, although neither the king nor his queen was very actively involved in the mission, at least in the beginning, they are allowed to preach. Augustine builds a monastery, which eventually, of course, becomes a bishopric. And one by one, in the course of the 7th century, each of the kings of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms adopts Christianity for himself. There was a second missionary push, and that was from the north in the course of the 7th century, and that was the Irish mission. Now, Irish Christianity was quite different. People tend to say it was different because they dated Easter differently and so forth, but the culture was very different. It was highly monastic, very individual. So in the 6th century, a monastery was established on Iona, an island off the coast of the Outer Hebrides. And then in the 7th century, in 634, these monks from Iona went over to Lindisfarne off the coast of Northumbria, so now in northern England, the island now called Holy Island, to found a monastery there. And it is here in Lindisfarne that we find an early center of missionary activity in the north. Now, as I said, these the monks, the Irish monks, they had a very different take on missionary activity and on Christianity as such. It was very monastic and sort of apolitical, anarchic. They did talk to kings, and they did convert kings in the north, but on the whole, Irish monks were not too keen on power structures and using, certainly not the Roman bishops for their purposes, but also using worldly power for their purposes. So over time, it was Roman Christianity that won out because the Roman church was not only a spiritual institution, a religious institution, it was also a wealthy secular institution. And so a king would rather be associated with that than with some monks here and there. Now, what are some of the consequences of the Christianization of Anglo-Saxon England? I could draw up a long list. I'll just touch on some points here. First, and perhaps most obviously, is suppression of pagan ritual and belief, and that is why we know next to nothing about pre-Christian religion in Anglo-Saxon England. There's also reinvigoration of international relations, because on the one hand, you have priests moving into Anglo-Saxon England, and sort of monks moving from one country to the next. Eventually, we have English monks and priests moving to Germany to come and evangelize here. And then, of course, there's also a market that opens up for pilgrimages to Rome and onwards. In art and literature, we get this really strong uniform orientation on Christian models. It's a large international culture, and everyone is now writing about Christianity and depicting Christian scenes. So it's a huge sea change in the orientation of art. And then finally, and very importantly for our purposes, of course, the reintroduction of the written word into England, which gives the Anglo-Saxons an opportunity to write down their narratives and their lyric poetry, which allows us to come together here all through this term and talk about their literature. Now, I want to go back to Sutton Hoo, where we started. Sutton Hoo is a site in East Anglia where there are quite a number of these mounds. And as I said, if something is buried in a mound, it's going to be a pagan burial, basically. A lot of them are just mounds like this one. But the one that housed the ship burial, mound number 17, I believe, was a little different for the very fact that it contained a ship. This, of course, is a model. So what people did is they dug a pit, and they put an entire ship inside it. Then they seem to have put either a coffin or a platform in it with the corpse, because, as I said, no corpse survives, but there's a slight discoloring of the soil that tells us there must have been a platform or a coffin or something, and surrounded it with grave goods. And then they built a mound over top of it with, if I remember correctly, an intact opening on the inside, which eventually caved in. Now, the boat does not survive either, because boats do not stand the test of time very well either, but it left an impression into the soil. It also left the metal rivets that kept the wood together. Now, as I said, some of the most astonishing grave goods were found here. There were some domestic objects. I've already mentioned the spoons, I think. There were some bowls as well. But, of course, people are mostly interested in the military finds. There was a sword, which is mostly rusted through, but the pommel is very finely decorated. There was a shield. Again, the wood has not survived, but the decorations have, and so they've been able to reconstruct it. We've already looked at the buckle, which, by the way, weighs over 400 grams. There are two of these shoulder clasps with animal motifs along the sides. There's this amazing helmet that fits all the way around the head, leaving only the eyes vulnerable. And there was also a musical instrument, sort of a lyre, that, of course, has not survived intact either, but it's still good enough that we can tell what it was. Now, Sutton Hoo was not the large find. This is a dig from the 30s, the 1930s, and in recent years, there have been some pretty amazing finds as well. For instance, in 2003, they discovered the so-called Prittawell Prince in Essex, which was an intact burial chamber. And by intact, I mean they dug into it, and things were still hanging from the ceiling. There was a corpse there, and just lots of household objects. And then in 2009, they unearthed the largest gold and silver stash ever found from Anglo-Saxon England. Interesting about this find is that all the objects in this collection are martial in a way. They're not complete weapons. There are no blades in there. But they're all pommels and other little objects that were stripped off weapons. So someone must have basically taken all the valuable parts of the weapons, brought them together, and buried them in hopes of recovering them later, but they never came back for it. So even though this is still going on, and there's archaeologists out there every day who are digging up new finds from the period, the Sutton Hoo ship burial really speaks to our imagination. And I think the reason for that is because it helps dissolve that boundary between history and literature, between object and text. Because some of the objects there found, the helmet, for instance, have strong echoes in Beowulf, our most extensive heroic poem. In fact, the mound itself, in which these finds were found, reminds us of Beowulf as well, because the burial mound number 17, it is located near a waterway in East Anglia. in such a way that if you were sailing by, you would be able to actually see the mound. And you would have seen not just the mound, because it's been, scholars have been able to figure out that the stem of the boat on both ends would have stuck out. So you're looking at a mound with, you know, two pieces of wood sticking out of it, which could have been quite impressive. Now, it so happens that at the very end of the poem Beowulf, I'm sorry to spoil the story for you, Beowulf, with his dying words, says, "I want a mound to be erected for myself by the sea where sailors can see it." So there's just a lot of parallels here. And whereas if you read Beowulf by itself, it's hard to believe that it represents anything like what society was like at the time that it was written down. But when we do finds like this, we see something of the veil being lifted, and there's a sense that perhaps there were some points of contact between history and literature. There's also art in manuscripts. Not in every manuscript, but some are really very lavishly illustrated, such as this one, the Lindisfarne Gospels. Lindisfarne, named, of course, after the monastery that we've already talked about. This book was written about the year 700 and contains some of these illustrations, especially at the start of chapters. So this is the start of the book of Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, and this is just a little bit later at Matthew 1:18, the so-called Cairo illustration, where the actual narrative of the Gospel starts. Now, it may not look like very much from a distance, but if you look more closely, you see that these illustrations are every bit as intricate as the artwork that we saw on the belt buckle. And in fact, some of these patterns might remind you of the interlace that we saw there. Now, I've set apart an entire session for manuscript culture to be hosted by my esteemed colleague, Dr. Voth. For now, though, I do want to ask what happened to Anglo-Saxon England. And I kind of want you to walk away with the idea that 1066 is overrated. That's... I'm exaggerating a little bit. 1066 was a very important year. Lots happened that hugely affected Anglo-Saxon culture. Of course, first of all, the entire administration was replaced by a Norman administration, and the languages of the administration were replaced from Latin and Old English. They became Latin and Norman French. Those are a big deal. But what I do want to convey is a sense that the two centuries leading up to the Norman conquest were hugely influential, had an enormous impact on Anglo-Saxon identity, certainly on the ruler level, but also for the society as a whole. So what happened then? 865, we get the arrival of the first Michelhere, a large army coming from Scandinavia. They land in East Anglia. They are bought off with horses. They mount these horses, ride them to York, and conquer York, which they then were to rule for the next century almost. About the same time, so shortly after they arrived, in fact, much of the island was conquered by Scandinavians. By the time that King Alfred comes to power in 871, it's pretty soon Wessex is the only Anglo-Saxon governed kingdom left. And in fact, at one point, King Alfred has to hide out in the marshes, and so he is a king without a kingdom by 878. Now, eventually, he manages to regain his kingdom and push back the Scandinavians and make a truce with them that included home rule for the Scandinavians north of a certain boundary. So they govern the area that we call the Danelaw, which is this darker patch on the map. And as you see, it is fully half the country. So by this point, you can ask yourself, is Anglo-Saxon England still Anglo-Saxon? Half of it is governed by Anglo-Saxons and inhabited by Anglo-Saxons. The other half is governed by Scandinavians and inhabited by both Scandinavians and Anglo-Saxons. Now, Alfred's children and grandchildren gradually conquer back part of the Danelaw, But by the late 10th century, we get a new wave of invasions. In fact, a new wave of raids. We get Scandinavian raiders coming down to England just to exact money in return for peace. And then they go on their way. And then they come back again a few years later and exact even more money. And they keep ramping up these fines. Until then, in 1013, Svein Forkbeard, king of Denmark, actually manages to conquer the country. His reign is short-lived, but just a couple years later, by 1016, we have Knut, whom we already encountered in the skaldic poem earlier, taking over all of England. And he founds a new dynasty. He and his sons end up ruling for several decades. Now, even if there is a return to Anglo-Saxon kings after this, by this point, the royal houses of Wessex and Norway and Denmark are so intertwined that you can never speak of purely Anglo-Saxon kings again. And so it goes on to 1066, by which point there is two major battles, and we don't have the time to go into this in any great detail, but the 25th of August, there's the Battle of Stamford Bridge in the north, when Harold Godwinson, the new king of England, has to defend his realm against a Norwegian contender, Harald Hardrada, and also Harold Godwinson's own brother is on the Scandinavian side. He manages to defeat them, but 3 days after the battle, William of Normandy lands in the south, in Kent. And so they march down south with their entire army, and within 3 weeks of that, fight a second battle at Hastings. And it is here that Harold dies, and the Normans take over the country, and that is the definitive end of Anglo-Saxon England. Now, I want to take just a final minute to address those of you who are either new to the field, who are here for the first time, and wondering what the relevance of all of this is to the rest of your lives, and also to address those of you who have come back here, are here for the third or fourth time, and are still wondering what the relevance of all of this is for the rest of your lives. I just want to put your minds at ease and say, look, you're in university to learn to think critically. This is something you can do in any field. But I would argue that, in fact, medieval studies is a particularly good field in which to learn these skills, because it is so interdisciplinary. You get to learn not just about literature, but about history. Inevitably, there's always religion involved. You have the choice to branch out into manuscript studies, archaeology, political history, and there's just a wealth of languages to learn, whether it's these five on the left that were spoken in medieval England, or any of their neighboring languages. And it is navigating a complex system like this that I would say constitutes what one might call leadership skills. And so, again, I just want to encourage you to spend your time in university learning about any one field and applying yourself to a field that fuels your passion, and then I promise you the skills will follow. For next week, we'll read just two short introductory essays to the language and, or rather, to the literary corpus of Anglo-Saxon England and into the nature of Old English verse. These texts are on Studio Pay. I hope to see you again next week. Until then, happy Halloween.